Welcome, dear listeners, once again to Food Conversations Season 9. But first, we openly and freely acknowledge that we live and work in Shukapmakulu, the stolen ancestral and unceded lands of the Shukapmak people. We in the settler community have a critical responsibility to do our very best to resolve this historical injustice in a way that is satisfactory to our Indigenous friends and neighbors. Now, change, we sometimes think, happens at the level of formally identified leadership, like government officials or corporate CEOs, and the change may not always be beneficial for all citizens. But there is a trend towards change led at the grassroots levels that is gaining strength and influence, and one constructive step at a time. It is change that is unassuming and often behind the scenes, but involves steps that benefit everyone because it usually embodies goals that meet basic needs and aspirations that we all have in common. Today, we're delighted to welcome into our studio someone who's helping facilitate positive change in a quiet and effective way that minimizes missteps and maximizes positive outcomes. Biologist Christine Tether is the manager of Salmon Arm's Downtown Farmers Market, and she's here to share her story of how that came about, why it matters, and how a farmer's market is a force for good in any community. Christine, welcome, very much welcome to Food Conversations.
Well, thank you for having me.
We're delighted to have you and your companion, who you're bringing along with you. You're about 6 weeks away from childbirth once again. Mm-hmm. And that will be a momentous time in your life. We're happy to have you here today, though, to talk about the issues that I just outlined in that introduction. And I wanted to start with a story you told me about a weevil and a child. Why don't you tell the weevil story for our listeners' delight?
Well, we were camping or visiting camping, and I have a little three-year-old who found a weevil. And she spent a good 30 minutes just looking at the weevil, asking questions, and being so wrapped up in this little tiny, it wasn't even any bigger than her pinky fingernail, and mm-hmm. she loved it.
What kind of questions was she asking you?
Well, first, what it was, yes. What it could do, mm-hmm. if it could fly, could it bite her?
Yes.
What would happen if she ate it? Those type 3-year-old questions.
Lovely. Well, you're describing the patience that a child can have when they're interested in something. They just get totally bodily involved with the whole process, and curiosity as well. Now, you're due for your fourth child next month. Why don't you talk a little bit about children as kind of a driving force in what you do? Because they're part of very much a big place in your life. How do they shape your view of the world and the world around you?
Well, I have three children already. Mm-hmm. They're 8, coming up on 6 and 3.
Yes.
And it was a big deal for me to make sure that they were appreciative of the environment and nature and all the little things that go into it. Mm. So I'm, from the very beginning, made it a big priority in our lives to have them be outside and be wrapped up in all that. And it's just nice to see them still doing that, even at almost, 8 years old.
And you're starting to see that you've inculcated certain values in them by the way you've raised them, by the environment you've created around them.
Mm-hmm. The hard work's paying off.
Yes, it is hard work. What if you were imagining your children growing up, what sort of citizens would you like them to be? What values do you want, hope that they will espouse and share with others?
I hope they would be community-minded. Like, mm-hmm. I know that we can't do it all ourselves. Mm-hmm. And like, I can't grow everything. I can't raise everything. And if they learn to work with other people and be in that community, I think that would be the goal in the end.
A very good thing.
Yeah.
Now, mothers with young children are the demographic in our society that are most concerned about changes in the ecosystem and the environment. Is that connection strong in you as well, like most other young mothers?
Very much. Yeah. Just wanting them to have something when they grow up.
Your 8-year-old is She's got an interest.
Very much so.
Why do you describe that?
She loves to garden, loves her animals. She spends a lot of time with our chickens and our ducks. She's actually part of our youth garden contest this year, so she is taking full reign of the garden. Mm. I'm there to help, but she is doing it all, and she loves it.
Birds. She's
and
into
birds.
She's
yes.
seriously into birds.
Yeah, her school program this year did birds as well. So they had a bird biologist in, and every time she hears a bird, she's running for the bird ID.
Our Merlin, famous Merlin program.
Mm-hmm. And she's got a bird book that looks like it's been used a lot. It's missing pages, and she's very much into it.
That must really warm your heart.
It does.
Yeah.
It does.
And your five-year-old?
She's there, too. She's just not as fully into it yet.
But you're talking about her demonstrating that sentiment of caring about the environment, of caring about creatures other than human.
Very much so. She likes to take care. Like she is a very caring person, and she wants everything to be taken care of.
You know, there's this notion that adults teach children, but it's also true that children teach adults. Mm-hmm. So how would you describe that reciprocity for you? You've made an effort to inculcate certain values and ways of looking at the world. What do they bring to the table?
I think they remind us to slow down and to take notice. Many times we'll be going for a walk and I have a goal and I'm like, we have to get to the mailbox. But really, we don't have to get there in 5 minutes. We can take a half an hour to look at the snails and to look at the plants and take our time and be patient.
And when you watch your children doing that, what does it connect you to your own growing up experiences that this world is a wonderful thing full of unusual and fascinating creatures?
It definitely does. I think I remember as a kid spending a lot of time in a tree looking at the things that were there and, yeah, taking the time. You didn't have anywhere else to be.
Isn't it a wonderful thing to take that time to just observe what's going on around us? There's so much mm-hmm. happening. I'm always surprised when kids from the city background say, well, there's nothing happening here. And there's so much happening in terms of other life forms. They're just mm-hmm. busy all the time. Now, one of the things that we talked about was your ambition that brought you to this part of the world, but also was in you for a long time, and that was the notion of homesteading. Why don't you give the definition you would have in your own mind of what homesteading means?
Homesteading means to me just being able to do some stuff at home, right? Raise our own animals, grow our food, be a part of that community too, because that's a big deal. And kind of go back to doing things from scratch.
You started early. You started in high school being interested in other creatures, what the indigenous folks called more than human creatures. What kind of things were you thinking about when you were exploring life forms and biology and learning stuff like that? What was going on in your mind?
I found the small things amazing, like the bugs and the little things and what they've been around for
sometimes
so long,
a long time,
so long,
many millions of years.
The amazing ability of them to adapt and, yeah. And some of these things are forgotten, right? We know a lot about the big mega fauna and flora, but not the little things.
Yeah, the apex species we think are the most interesting, but it's the little ones. You know, the number of organisms in a cubic inch of soil is astonishing. Well, you actually lucked out when you went to post-high school education. You went to UBCO, but you weren't sure what you wanted to do, you said. So you tried different things. Why don't you list a few of the things you tried before you really got into what you thought was...
Yeah, I started actually in chemistry. Hmm. And then I moved on to biochem. And then just plain biology. And then into ecology. It changed my major numerous times.
At each step, what were you experiencing that sort of pulled you forward? You know, say, oh, no, I want to go beyond that. I want to go farther. I want to broaden what I'm doing.
I think it was just a lot of the classes, a lot of the teachers, and then the reason they make you try a bunch of things and you take electives is to figure out what you actually want to do. And it led me into different classes, into different professors, and then eventually into that one program.
The world of living creatures is I mean, it connects us to the world in totally different ways. But you really lucked out because when you were going to UBCO, there was a new program. Mm-hmm. And you were one of, what, seven
students?
I think so. I mean, extraordinary. When you think of what young people find when they go to university, they're in a class. The first class is like 200 people.
Yeah.
And the other class is 400 people and something else is 300 people. What was it like being part of this pretty intimate, flexible program?
It made it much easier to follow what we all wanted to do with only like... It was the second year the program had been there, and UBCO was fairly new at the time too. And we were able to kind of point what we wanted to do, where we wanted to go. And a lot of us were very similar. So it helped that we could tailor what we wanted to learn.
So what are some things you said, or you and your classmates said, we'd like to do this that maybe hadn't been on the program originally, but were accepted by your teachers?
We ended up diving pretty good into conservation genetics, actually a few of us, and one got a lot of birding.
So why, conservation genetics, why, for listeners, just kind of outline what that basically means, what you study when you're studying conservation genetics.
So what we were studying is a lot of times was how different populations worked together of the same species and how the genetics changed. So the professor we worked with actually worked with Siberian tigers in China and talking about how the rail or the highway had impacted two different populations. Were they crossing over? Was that traffic impacting how the tigers moved? He also worked on Galapagos tortoises and how there was one that was 100 something years old, but he was the last of his species and whether they could get him
to mate
with a different one that was close in genetics, but not completely.
Did it work?
I don't think so. I think Lonesome George died.
It was too choosy.
Yep.
This opportunity to kind of shape the program, it doesn't happen very often when people go to university. It's usually, you know, you have to take this, you have to take that if you do prerequisites. You and your other six students, have you celebrated over the years the fact that you, I mean, do you keep in touch with them? It must have been quite an intimate association.
I know a few of them still.
Yeah.
And they all kind of went off in their own different direction and throughout the province and different things.
But similar kinds of work that you ended up doing.
In a way, yeah. One did bird conservation up north and that kind of thing.
I just think of my early days at university, and the classes were so big that you could sit at the back and nobody would even know you were there because they were just huge. It was, you described when you're talking about it, you described you were moving towards life, towards living creatures as opposed to the chemistry of, you know, chemicals and stuff like that in test tubes. That seems to be a theme. Just to remind listeners that I'm speaking with biologist Christine Tether, who is the manager of Salmon Arms Downtown Farmers Market. Now, one aspect of genetics is epigenetics, and epigenetics is a field that is not that old. We've been focused on changes in DNA and that kind of thing, but epigenetics is a really important area because it's how many creatures adapt to situations quick enough that they don't go extinct. Was that something that you looked at, and how did that shape your sense of how the world is and how adaptation takes place? Because it's such an important thing for creatures like these Siberian tigers. If they couldn't cross the highway, or if they crossed the highway and, you know, got wiped out by some truck or something, it was obviously, if they could figure out what the highway was like and adapt to it, they would make it.
Yeah, it's passing on those knowledge and
Was that part of what you were learning and studying and probably being enthusiastic about?
I feel like it was probably, we did a bit of it because it was still kind of, it's a while ago. And the world of genetics has changed even so much in the last 10 years. So we probably touched on it, but not surprising.
So what kind of changes are going on in that field? Because obviously you were immersed in it at the time, but
I'm assuming the technology just to study it has changed. Like we would take days to get DNA from things.
Yes.
And I'm thinking it's probably a lot faster now.
Oh,
and different.
Extraordinary difference.
Yeah.
And people talk about AI,
mm-hmm.
and it really can speed things up because you can just suck in all sorts of information and collate it faster than going through dictionaries and
days
reading books. Now, after you'd finished your bachelor's degree, you were considering going on to a master's, but life happened.
Mm-hmm.
So how was life redirecting you away from the academic world?
Well, we ended up moving to Williams Lake instead. Mm. It was kind of a, when we graduated, who got a job first kind of situation.
Yes.
So we ended up in Williams Lake for a few years.
Was there some concern that the field wouldn't be a field where you could get work? I mean, that...
Unless it was a big center, finding a job in genetics is, at the time, was fairly limited.
But ecology covers the whole system,
yes.
Right?
And it was another one, the time moving up north probably would have got me a job as well. Like the jobs were either in a big center or
way, way far
away. Up north.
But you did get a job.
I did. Took a bit. I ended up working for an environmental consultant.
And your first child was already...
Nope. This is still just...
Just before.
Yeah.
Ah, well, there you are. You had time to wait.
I had time.
So you worked for an environmental consultant.
Mm-hmm.
And what does his work expose you to?
We worked a lot for fisheries as well as for water quality in the mining departments, for mines and exploration companies. So we did water quality, we tested fish, we did that type of stuff.
Now that's that work usually means you have, when you're a consultant, you have client, you're a client.
Yep.
Or somebody you're working for. What was that like? Because... both in mining and in other, you know, activities out in the natural ecosystem, there's lots of pressures from proponents of projects to go in a certain direction because that will help their project. How did you and your boss, I suppose, mostly, deal with that kind of slicing and dicing? Yeah,
balance. I think there's a lot that goes in with the licensees and with the proponents of... There's, a lot of political things. There's a lot of money stuff. I think with us, we just did the work we were asked, did it well and got the results and
said, there they are.
There they are.
If you don't like it, sorry.
This is what's it.
Was that, when you saw that kind of interface and you were actually in it, what was that like to think of the values that you were developing in yourself and matter to you, not always shared by, say, proponents, and you kind of have to swallow hard and say, okay.
I think it was a learning curve for someone right out of university, too, right? It was not everyone thinks like this. Like, not everyone wants the same things in the end. So it was a bit of learning.
How did you deal with that yourself, for yourself?
Again, I think just doing the best we could do,
mm-hmm.
and making sure we had found, we did what we needed to do. Mm-hmm. We weren't going to not.
Now, you pointed out a little historical fact that I wasn't aware of, and that was that there was an environmental, in-house environmental person for Polymines.
Mm-hmm. The whole department.
Yes. Yeah. And you saw in this person, who I think had already died before the big mining disaster took place, he was actually very dedicated. He was very committed.
He was very, very committed, very much wanted his work. Like, he wanted that mine to be as environmentally friendly as he possibly could get it. And he was, very dedicated to that.
Did you see a struggle in him trying to adapt to the corporate values, as it were?
From what I've met, we didn't see him that often, but from when we did actually have conversation, you could see that. Yes.
It's just one of the things that the 21st century is bringing us face to face with. Mm-hmm. We have to reconcile a project that is not in good odor with respect to the environment, we have to say, well, maybe we should change it or even not do it sometimes. Mm-hmm. Then your next job was quite a different one. Why don't you describe the Tsilhqot'in?
So with the environmental consultant, actually, we ended up doing projects for the Tsilhqot'in national government, which when my boss, he ended up leaving for a provincial government job, I got a job with
Tsilhqot'in.
The Tsilhqot'in, yeah. So I worked in their mining department. Mm. So we were examining the water analysis that was coming back and going out and visiting exploration and mining sites to make sure they were following what we wanted.
Yeah, and Tsilhqot'in have had this longstanding struggle around a mine that was proposed on their land, which eventually they managed to
hold back. Two environmental, Canadian environmental assessments through that mine, and both got denied for the mine company. Hopefully they stay away from
it. Which didn't make them happy, did it?
It did not.
What was it like being sort of in the middle of that and watching this play back and forth between a proponent who's hell-bent for leather to make money out of a resource, as they would call it, as opposed to a community that says, but the land and the values of the land are really important.
It was amazing to see how, like you say, hell-bent the community was on getting that stopped. They would do anything to protect their land. And it was nice to see that we were able to even collect more community from all over the province. We had experts come from Vancouver and from Ottawa to speak on behalf. And it was amazing to see everyone kind of come together and fight for what they believed in.
I remember following that whole process mm-hmm. over a number of years, and I'm sure there were a lot of people holding their breath, say, will this work? Will a small indigenous community be successful against a large corporate player mm-hmm. that is very focused on getting this to go through? What was it like as you, I don't know if you were there when the final decisions were made, but what was it like for you to see that this indigenous community prevailed, that they were able to hold off this, what was in fact a pretty destructive, mm-hmm. environmentally speaking, a pretty destructive project.
It was amazing to see them have a victory. I think they were still a little holding their breaths because it had gone through already, got denied, and then it came back. And I think by the second time, they were a little wary that it would...
might not work.
But they were still able to hold it off, so it was nice to see.
So as a future homesteader and... you know, somebody, by this time, I think you did have one of your children.
No, not yet.
Oh, you're still doing a solo. My goodness. Well, probably because you had a lot of work to do. But I'm wondering, when you see something like this, it must resonate and sort of affirm in some way the things that you were moving towards that they'd already moved towards quite a bit.
Yeah. Seeing that community already there, right? It's not like you're doing it alone. And you can see that people are, they might not be out in the open all the time, but there are people that have the same values. And
this is sort of connecting back to the remarks I was making at the beginning about how important it is to have a good relationship with the land. But also one of the things you said in your remarks before was how important community is and how different it is to do something as part of a community than trying to do it on your own. Mm-hmm. What then was the next step for you? At some point you said, okay, this is all right, but the idea of homesteading was still pretty strong in you.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the step that you took and that led you to this part of the world?
Well, my husband eventually got a transfer down here. So when we came down, we ended up purchasing like a small lot or house in the middle of Blind Bay, like very not homesteady.
Not rural.
But the previous owner was very big on her garden. She had all like any fruit you could ever want in that yard, which started into then us building a garden and us getting farther in that. And then I started a forestry job here, and my coworkers there were very big on like mushroom hunting and all the things. A lot of them
Where was that? Which job was that?
It was with Landmark Solutions here. And sure. So I was in there for 5 years. So like getting the knowledge from those coworkers who are already part of that, kind of built on that. And then we moved again and get bigger property.
Looking around for the place that you thought mm-hmm. you could really put your roots into.
Yeah.
So how did you find the place and what was special about it?
Well, just last year we ended up selling our house without anywhere to go. We had a bigger property at the time. We just put it up for sale and hoped for the best. And luckily the house we found fell into the realtor's lap. It wasn't even for sale. And we walked in and within 15 minutes, it was like, yep, this is it. And it was a nice bigger property out in Notch Hill. And it had a lot of potential.
So what made you say, this is it? What triggered that sense?
It had a forest. That was one of my things. We wanted some privacy. We also wanted, it had a nice little farmhouse on it already, as opposed to us having to, we talked about living in a yurt at one point, because we might have had to.
Not the first person. I've had another person within a week or so talk about living in a yurt.
Yeah, we were basically living in a tent trailer at a friend's house before that. So, yeah, we had...
A house was like untold luxury.
Yeah, and this one had, the chickens were already there. The garden was set up. It had a pond and a creek and a forest. And it was like we could do whatever we wanted.
These people were clearly anticipating your arrival. Oh, my goodness. I remind listeners, once again, I'm speaking with biologist Christine Tether, who is the manager of Salmon Arms Downtown Farmers Market. So what is it about the shoe swap that really tickled your fancy?
We like it here just because you can do basically anything. All seasons, we've got the beach, we've got hiking, you've got skiing close by. Anything we would want to do is here.
Yeah. You can grow things.
And you can grow things. Being in Williams, like, there's a growing season. It's just definitely not the same.
It's interesting how people resonate with a particular ecosystem, use that term. And this area has, one of my very first patients had a job in Kamloops selling carpets at Sears, and his wife worked in California as a medical office assistant, so they could keep their home in this area. Mm-hmm. So it's a sentiment that we've heard often expressed since coming here. You know, it's sometimes serendipity leads you to the place, and progressively you know this is better, and you find a place you really like. Now, your parents were city folks.
Yep.
Your dad's a mechanic. Mm-hmm. Did your mom, was she a stay-at-home mom?
She worked for a couple companies. She worked for BC Gas at one point, for Eaton's way back. I believe she had her accounting when they were in Calgary.
So these are city jobs.
Yep.
What were their thoughts about you and your ambitions and your values and what you wanted to do?
I think with them, they just, as long as we found, like my little brother and I found something we liked and we went towards, regardless of what it was.
Sure.
They were happy with that.
And that's always nice.
Yep.
You don't have a preformed plan set out for you. You
No.
can go whichever direction you like. What about the community here? Because it's a more abundant ecosystem than many other places in the province. But what did you see and what did you want to see and what did you find in the community itself?
I think the community and the people here are accepting, but that's not the word I'm looking for. They want to love on the community. Like anything local is like what they want. And it's nice to see that. And even in the last couple of years, I've noticed a lot of people have come up from the coast looking for that community.
Looking for a sense of community.
Yeah.
A community that has some kind of coherence
mm-hmm.
and mutual support.
Yep.
Well, that's certainly something we do at the radio station. We look for that, and there is a lot of it in this community. So why don't we talk a little bit about your job? Because you have a job besides managing the lives of three small humans and a fourth on the way. What led you to get into that particular job? I mean, it's always serendipity. There's always a certain amount of serendipity. What was your serendipitous story?
I hadn't been working for a few years just because forestry camp work is hard with little kids. So I had just been hanging out at home. And after we sold the house, we were looking for something for me to do. And it just happened that Shuswap Food Action posted about the farmer's market. And I jumped on that pretty quick.
Why did you jump on it? Because obviously it must have hit a responsive chord.
Being in with all these farmers and homesteading people, as well as just the social and community aspect of it, I thought would fill my cup a bit more than being home all the time.
And you'd also been going to the Buckerfields.
Yes, we've been doing Sunday sessions.
Yes.
My oldest daughter and I, every week, she'd sit there for 2 hours and learn.
When you saw that, how did that impact you when you saw your daughter so involved and interested in what was going on?
Like, you have to lean into that when your kids are into something, especially something that is similar to what you enjoy.
Yes.
We leaned into it very much so.
Then you got the job.
Mm-hmm.
And had you ever done anything like this before, like organizing a bunch of people? You'd been part of work, different kind of work situations.
Not organizing this many people. It'd been mostly just me on my own the grunt, the bottom of the...
Yes, the junior grunt, you called yourself.
Yes, yeah, which was fine. I was okay with that too. But yeah, not with having to organize a good amount of people.
What helped you through that learning process of getting a grip on managing a crowd?
The previous manager, Howie, he was...
Howie McMillan?
Yeah, he was a big help. And yeah, he was...
And he hung around for quite a while.
He stayed around with me until the end of August. And he was there. He was a volunteer, and he was there every single week.
What's that like, having volunteers who work just as hard as people who are being paid?
It's amazing to me.
Yes.
That he was there, him and a few others are there all the time, just out of the goodness of their heart, to help out.
That's something that people have talked about, this community, that there are there are volunteers involved in just about everything that's going on. Has that been an experience you've had as well?
Yeah, I hadn't experienced that before. Just being in industry and all that, it's a different world. And now having the ability just to call upon a list of people that are more than willing.
Is there kind of a typological or a characterological difference between people working as volunteers and people working as employees? Or
I don't know if there is. I think it depends on when they're passionate about something, and as well as more community minded. But I think as an employee, you can still be the same.
Yep, sure. Like the environmental manager at mm-hmm. Poly Mines.
He's still, yeah.
Right in the middle
He's still passionate about it.
Exactly.
He changed from the inside too, right?
So when Howie was manager, we had him on and we got him to tell what he did. But why don't you describe what you do? And, you know, you had Howie's experience, but how did you end up, how is the market shaped now? Meaning, what's a typical day?
Typical market day?
Yes.
Market day, we get there. I've been getting there really early.
What time do you get up in the morning?
With the summer market, it's going to be about 5:30 because I also live out of town, so it takes a while. And I have yet to beat some of these vendors there. Even though they're told to get there at 7, they are there early.
And there's no grass growing under their feet.
No. So we get there generally around 7 where we close off this year the parking lot and start getting everyone set up. Most of what I do that for the first 2 hours is tell people where to go and different where they're laid out. And
do you always have the same plan? For the most part.
Mm. And then when cancellations happen and different events and stuff, things change a bit.
Right.
But for the most part, we should have the same layout every time. It's just the beginning of this year, especially because it's new to the parking lot. It's been a whole learning curve of how we all fit in and where we all can be.
For everybody.
Like everyone's in a different spot than last year because it's in a different place.
And what did they say? Am I supposed to be there? Or
yeah.
Why am I here?
Well, that's the first couple of weeks, even just figuring out where, like there's no markers. How do you get everyone fitting?
Yes.
In the space we have. So yeah, for the first 2 hours, it's just getting them all in with their vehicles and out and set up.
Sounds like a bit of organized chaos.
It very much is.
Herding cats? Does herding cats work?
Surprisingly, it was our first summer market last week, and it went surprisingly well.
So here's a question. Is it easier to organize a bunch of vendors at a farmer's market or get your children to do the things that you think they ought to be doing?
I don't know, actually.
Equal?
About equal.
Well, it just shows there's an inner child in everybody.
Yep.
So you get people in their places. You sometimes have some variations.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a little bit of a schedule. They have to get certain things done by certain times. How does that work?
So by 8:15, they have to have all their vehicles out. Like, we close. Like, it's no more vehicles in, just for safety of mm-hmm. people showing up early or whatever. And by, I would hope, for 8:45, they have everything ready to go and ready for people to come. Because a lot of times people do come early, even though it starts at 9.
I've done it. I know what you mean. Get the best deals before all the product is.
So most of them are ready to go. Again, some of them are ready to go by 7:15. Right there. They're set up and ready.
Now, you have a couple of features. One is music.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that a little bit. I know it started when Howie was there, but how's the arrangement working now?
So the Downtown Salmon Arm Association is the one that plans all the music and entertainment for the year. And they have, I believe, an application people have to fill out, and they schedule it all the way up until the very end of summer market at the end of October.
What does that do, the music? What does that do to the market?
It gives it a sense of just people hang around and chat and watch and be, it's an event as opposed to just coming and doing your grocery shopping.
You know, it's funny, corporate players have learned about mood music, you know, Muzak,
mm-hmm.
but this is live music.
Mm-hmm.
What's the power of live music?
I think people are just gravitated towards it and seeing that who's actually the one performing, and mm-hmm. it is someone from the community.
Sure.
So it's, yeah. Again, community-minded.
And sometimes you see kids dancing around.
Very much. I even at the end of the winter market had kids coming and looking for the music and for the band, like the ribbons and the bubbles and all the things that they play with on the grass there.
Now, you had a big deal on Earth Day.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't you describe this sort of different things you did for Earth Day?
So with Earth Day, I believe at Song Sparrow Hall and Downtown Salmon Arm arranged to have other like local businesses and local nonprofits come and present and talk about why Earth Day was important to them and the things they were doing in the community. We had up to, I think, 11 other, I say vendors, but booths that were doing things like the Shoe Shop Climate Action, and I think Makerspace was there for something else too. And it was, yeah.
That's these are organizations that are building community in, mm-hmm. in some formal way. What does their presence at the farmer's market? They're not selling food. They're not selling crafts. They're just talking about what matters to them in the community.
Yeah. I think it's just awareness. They get a lot of people don't know these organizations exist. I think just having them there and the awareness, and you're just walking by and there's some sort of thing to do or kids activity and they bring people in.
I've often seen you at the market walking around and kibbutzing with people.
Yeah.
What's that like for you as somebody who's, you know, you haven't been here that long? These people are very welcoming. It's a great place to be. There's other homesteaders
mm-hmm.
as vendors as well. What does that atmosphere do for you?
I really enjoy it. I have a hard time sitting in my own tent. I like to walk around and chat and see what's going on and visit, and it fills my extrovert cup for the week.
Well, there's certainly a lot of extroverts. I think the best vendors are the ones who can talk mm-hmm. on a dime and spin on a dime as well. Then, of course, each time you have to disband. It's astonishing to me how quickly things can get set up and then how quickly they can be taken down. Does that strike you as well?
Yeah, at the end of the day, that all 50 plus of them can take down and get in and out within the hour is amazing to me.
Is that because they're experienced or just because they...
Yeah, Some of them it is experience. Some of them have been around for a very long time. They know what they're doing. Hmm. But I think a lot of it's just, it's the end of the day. They're also a little bit ready to go home, and hopefully they have less stuff to
gear
pack
to
up.
Take. Exactly. How many of the vendors that, when you're talking to them, do you see are making a reasonable living just from farmers markets?
Well, I know a few of them that have actually like quit their day jobs, and this is what they do full time, is they do markets and other sales. And so it's...
Is there a kind of a mentality that develops when you are doing, when you are a vendor in something like this? Obviously, it's selling, as it were, but what you're selling is being sold in an environment that's very compatible to what you're doing. What is that? What's your perception of what that does to people's minds? You're not in a store. You're not an employee. You're not working for somebody else. You're doing your own thing with your own stuff, your own food that you've prepared, your own crafts that you've prepared. It's a different kind of ecosystem, I can use the term.
Yeah.
Social ecosystem.
I think a lot of these vendors really like selling to the community and to the locals and being there for them, kind of thing.
Yeah,
so I think it's a different mindset.
I certainly can attest to the fact that when you arrive, the atmosphere is always, it's just mellow or positive or whatever. I don't, it's hard to be at a farmer's market and feel grumpy. You get trained out of it pretty quickly. Remind listeners once again that our guest today is biologist Christine Tether, who is the manager of Salmon Arms Downtown Farmer's Market. So when you leave the market is shut down, everything is closed and, you know, done and dusted, as they say, and you go home. What's the first thing you do when you get home?
I sit down.
You sit down.
And I try not to do anything for the rest of the day.
But you have a tribe. You have a little tribe.
I don't get to sit down.
Well, there you are. Now the truth comes out. What, when you get back to your home, is parallel to the sentiments you have when you're in the market? It's a similar kind of place. It's a place where you feel good. There's constructive things to do, but it's a little different because children are somewhat different. What is the bringing children into this space that you value so much? What is that like? You obviously, there's other parents who have kids and you've got to know them. What kind of interactions do you have when you're with these groups of parents and children together? How do you connect that to what you're doing at the market and the values we've talked about already that have been in your mind for a long time?
I think we end up with I'm part of a lot of different kids groups just because, a little bit extroverted. So I've been doing all the things. And I think we ended up gravitating towards other groups of people that are similar, and we make sure we have a priority of making with that whole group of kids being outside and sharing that with other families that may be not naturally inclined to doing it.
So what you read of you know, the parents with small children that you know, in terms of their openness to thinking about ecosystems as opposed to thinking about resources and exploitation thereof, which has been a big problem for our society, that attitude.
I think most of the parents I meet are very open to having their kids live more of a natural, simple, calm life. And they see that the hustle and bustle may not, especially with the little guys, it's easier and better for them to slow down.
What about things like digital technology? It's a big deal in many people's minds. What's your feeling about that in terms of enhancing the values that you espouse and that you think are important?
It has its place. But for us, like personally for us, we use it for bird ID and plant ID, but it's not a main thing in our home. But it definitely has its place.
So it's not so much a distraction as it is
a tool
that you use to search for things.
Mm-hmm.
Do your kids know about AI? I mean,
no,
indirectly.
Not even.
But I mean, do they, you can do searches.
Actually, yeah. And my oldest she will ask Google things.
Yeah.
Because I'm trying to get her to type it out, so at least then she's spelling. But
yes, and the computers programs are very unforgiving when it comes to spelling variants, shall we call it.
Yeah.
When you said that there are parents who are open to having the kids in the natural world, but you've also started up your own kids' playgroup.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we.
What was the motivation for that?
Part of it was getting us outside, regardless of the weather. I wanted to have us exploring. And a lot of it is what we do at our group is my girls actually pick a place every week, a park. It was part of a homeschool project.
So they're directors.
We pick a park or a trail and we just tell the group, this is where we're going. If you'd like to come, dress for the weather and here we go. And it helped us get out to places that maybe I wouldn't go on my own, as well as bring other moms out that...
So what kind of creative choices do your kids come up with sometimes?
We end up at Harold a lot, okay. Or White Lake Park.
Yes.
Sometimes we do Rocky Point Beach and Blind Bay, like just kind of wherever, Skamekin a couple times. We had fires out there, and yeah, they just pick where.
And do the kids direct traffic? Let's go over here.
Yeah, well, we do what they want, basically. Yeah. The whole point of this one that we started up was just to wander. There was
wander in the wild.
Of the year, a couple years ago, they do it now too with the North South Shoe Swap Community Resources. They do hikes, like toddler mom hikes, mm-hmm. but it's you're going to a location. And what we found is that some of us would end up still at the beginning with our kids picking up rocks in the parking lot.
Sure.
And just wandering through the forest. So we thought, well, why don't we do one where we are just wandering?
This sounds wonderful. It's like children directing traffic.
Yeah.
Only it's not large vehicles that could squash you. It's little bugs that you could stop and pay attention to.
Like very many times we end up trying to go on a hike and find a creek. And that is it. We make it 30 feet from the parking lot.
When you engage in a child-directed activity, how does it change things?
It makes it less rushed and less of a goal. Like that they're not thinking we have to go do this. They're thinking that this is cool. Let's see what it does. Or they play a different way, or they do take a bit more risks, but with each other. And they make friends almost easier, I think.
Well, they don't have preordained prejudices being inculcated in them.
Yeah, they're just there.
Yeah. If you're nice,
yeah.
We'll be nice.
Mm-hmm.
How does it feel to be part of a child-directed group? I mean, obviously other parents must go along with it, right? Is it mostly mothers, by the way?
Most of the time. There are a few dads that come out. And one of them is one of my vendors, too.
Oh, there you are.
We mushed a couple groups together there. Yes. But.
So having children direct traffic, as it were, how does that change your mindset? I mean, it's not just you're observing it, you're actually participating in it, and to some extent seeing the world through their eyes, because they're saying, look what I see here.
It makes us slow down, too. Right? Mm-hmm. Like, you're just stopping for a second. Well, and it's nice with this group is just you're also hanging out with other parents that are also experiencing that.
What do you talk about, you parents, as you watched your children?
Children. It's always just about them.
What? Oh, what an extraordinary
and
idea.
How much we like being there with each other.
Yes.
And commiserating sometimes.
Does this end up, without anybody thinking about it, generating a certain set of values that just animate the group?
I think so. And I think it ended up generating a bit of a village too, right? Like I think we're missing that, like that community with parents, but like that ability, we would all step in to help any of those kids and any of those families.
You know, wandering in the wild, it just seems like, I mean, if you do it purposefully, in the sense that I am interested in this as opposed to I am being made to do this, it seems to me that it allows so much more opportunity for spontaneous emotional responses to take place, animated by the mind. You know, their children's minds are working all the time and presumably asking questions and wanting to know and say, I want to find out more about this. You know, they don't just ask you, they ask themselves. Mm-hmm. And they actually, do you see them interacting in say a different way from say on a sports team or something that's adult or there must be a little bit more animation coming from.
The imaginary play these kids get into, that's some of them are.
Do you have any examples that?
This week there was a group of 5 to 6 year olds. They were wild cats and they were in the tree. They're together and like just out of sight, but the three of them were having a grand old time. And they'd come running back, telling us all about it, and then off they go.
A little reassurance from parents, and then go back and start it up again. Do you see this as, comparing to this, the work you do at the farmer's market and, you know, child rearing in your own home, do you see this as something that is important for maybe adults to start getting attuned to child-directed curiosity and maybe reawakening our own curiosity through that process?
I think with all the stuff that as adults we have to do and all the hustle and bustle, we don't tend to take a step back and just wander, right? We don't prioritize that as much.
Yes, we have a prearranged notion in our head of what we should be doing.
Yeah, and what productivity is.
Yes, indeed. Well, I mean, that is an interesting point because productivity is defined by widgets produced as opposed to energy generated. Mm-hmm. Energy generated means you're enthusiastic, you care, you want to do something. And you see this, it's quite striking to me how kind of creative this process of having a child directed activity take place. I mean, genuinely, it's not like it's a playground and there's only one thing to do, which is play with a ball. You're out in the woods and a natural ecosystem where there's a million things to do. Do your children ever surprise you with the questions they ask?
Very much so. They come up with all sorts of things.
What kind of things?
Oh, how the world works. We were driving out to Scotch Creek the other day, so we were talking about the fires and what happens after. And they're even understanding, I don't know if I had said it or if they just had came up with how the succession of the plants grow and the seeds from the trees after and that type of thing. They were just
asking questions.
They were asking questions and telling me about it.
Yes.
I was like, oh.
Really?
Yeah.
And how was that? Were they just sort of spontaneously generating that sort of insight in their minds?
Yeah. Like it was interesting to listen. Like they had me turn the music off and everything so they could talk about the trees and the forest and how green it, like the ground looked and why.
It sounds wonderful. It sounds wonderful. Now it's interesting. I asked you about, you know, the parents, were they, you know, both sexes or and you said, and didn't surprise me by saying it's mostly women. What are your thoughts about women playing a central role in the kind of transformations that society needs to go through and in certain ways with the kind of stuff we've just been talking about is going through, you know, bringing the spontaneity and curiosity of children to the forefront? What is your sense about any kind of trend that you've seen, not just here, but in your life as you've been working through these different situations? Trend towards women actually playing a directing role, not the same, you know, do this, do that, but more of a, why don't we do this? Mm-hmm. Let's try that.
I think we're beginning to be more of, that villager community, and they're relying on other women to kind of come together to help teach our children these things and to help connect different groups of people in different ways and that type of thing.
Your husband's a social worker.
He is.
What's he see? Here's dealing with the human family in a very different way. How does he feel about these kinds of things with his own kids?
I think he loves it. He loves seeing them be independent and be curious and just out there, like, and being part of a group, bunch of groups of people and connecting and...
we're pretty much out of time now, but what a delightful note to end on. The world where children are allowed to teach us to reconnect to our innate curiosity and get away from formulas and narrow paths and, as you said, wander in the wild. It's really lovely having you here. Christine, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.